Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Welcome to another episode of Missing Frames. This is the podcast where we watch movies we probably should have seen by this point in our lives. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. Joining me for the first time ever in the history of his life, Mr. Dan Rayner. Dan, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
Dan, do you want to tell the audience how we know each other?
Oh, man. I met Sean through some mutual friends. We went to college together.
We went to college together, but at different times. We were there together in spirit, though,
Sean,
I would say.
Sean is a fossil from another era.
Exactly.
I'm a young upstart.
I'd like to say I paved the way, but if you want to call me a fossil, that's okay. I'll take that, too.
You're a patriarch.
That's right. And then the other thing we realized is that I know your uncle.
Very randomly, we found out Sean is good friends with my uncle.
Yes. And he's my dad's best friend. He was the best man at my dad's second marriage. So this is a historic event. This is a beautiful friendship we have, and I'm thrilled that now you're finally on Missing Frames.
Worlds collide.
Have you ever been on a podcast ever before in your life?
I have never been on a podcast ever before.
Well, then this is the last podcast. I mean, everything is downhill from here. You can never be on another podcast because nothing will hold up to this experience.
I'm certain of it. This is the most important moment of my life leading up to now.
I can tell. So the reason we're doing this is it was kind of actually a little bit of a, I don't want to say an accident, but it was a little bit kind of spontaneous Missing Frames because we were talking about this movie. This is a movie I've never seen before that you had seen. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like, well, do you want to just like make a Missing Frames episode about it, out of it? And I'd been talking to you about being on the show.
Sure.
And the movie is My Dinner with Andre, which, like I said, I've never seen it. When I think My Dinner with Andre, my first thought is comedy with black people. I don't know if that makes me racist, but for some reason, for the longest time, I thought My Dinner with Andre was kind of like a Guess Who's Coming to Dinner type movie, where it was like, oh, it's an awkward, like, white people bringing a black man into their world.
Like a Spike Lee.
Right, exactly. So I think maybe that just shows our audience that I feel like the audience just feels like I'm a horrible racist human being. Dan, do you think that's true?
I can neither confirm nor deny that fact.
I feel like I should just delete this entire portion out of the episode. So we'll see how that goes. But I didn't realize. So first of all, Wallace Shawn is in this movie. I had no idea. I didn't know Wallace Shawn was in movies other than The Princess Bride and that he was in serious, like, artistic films. Not that there's anything wrong with The Princess Bride. We did do a Princess Bride episode for Missing Frames, and I love that movie, but I always think of him as, like, inconceivable, and I didn't realize he did other movies.
This might be the polar opposite of Princess Bride.
Well, then we can't watch it. I changed my mind. But no, it's just, it's crazy. Yeah. Like, I feel like a lot of people know him through Princess Bride. So how did you first watch, like, when did you discover My Dinner with Andre? Was it something someone told you about, or did you stumble on it yourself?
I feel like I absorbed just the name of the movie and the concept of the movie through osmosis during film school. And I think I saw it in the school library. I never watched it, but I generally understood the premise of it. And I remember the Community did a parody of it with one of the characters, and just little nods to it here and there. And eventually I decided I kind of need to see it. I remember I saw a Roger Ebert interview where he was talking, just raving about it. Mm. He set up a special screening for it, a revival screening with a Q&A with the actors. And just, I know he personally was fascinated with the film. And I've been going through a phase where I'm into philosophy. So right. I've heard it's very philosophically dense and interesting, this conversation between these two characters in the movie. So right. I figured I should watch it.
You figured you should watch it. And then so this was recent, or did you watch it in film school?
This was recent. This was okay. 2 months ago, a month okay. ago. And it kept me up at night. It was absolutely fascinating.
You described this in a very specific way to me. What was that description?
I said it's the scariest movie I've ever seen.
Can you explain or elaborate without spoiling it for me or the audience, or can you give me a taste of what's to come, what we're about to embark on?
A lot of scary quote-unquote movies, there's a monster or there's a threat, but it's contained within the narrative. Mm. The threat in the monster in My Dinner with Andre is in our society and in our everyday lives, and there seems to be no escape from that monster, and it makes you horribly aware of society and how it's organized and the limitations of it.
And from my understanding, this is just it takes place in one location. They're kind of in a restaurant, and they're just talking over the table these just little bitty ideas.
It is almost entirely in one location. There are shots leading up to the dinner okay. and after the dinner, but the vast majority of the film is two people having dinner and drinks.
That's awesome. Yeah. So it's just their conversation.
Almost exclusively their conversation.
And are they playing? So it's not a documentary. It's they're kind of playing themselves, but it's scripted.
It's from what I understand, it was meticulously rehearsed. It was very well scripted, and it was, you know, designed, the ebb and the flow were designed by a screenwriter, but the ideas and the characters were inspired by the actors who played them,
right.
And they brought a lot of ideas to the table during the rehearsals.
Okay, that's awesome. Because anyone who knows me, anyone who's listened to this podcast knows I'm a huge fan of, like, dialogue-driven films, but specifically mm-hmm. I'm a huge fan of Richard Linklater,
sure.
who, you know, the Before trilogy, which we've been doing on this podcast, and Boyhood and other movies of his, take on that vibe. And it's funny, when you mentioned My Dinner with Andre, like I said, I had a really completely misguided thought of what this movie was, and when I started to research it and realize what it was, I realized how much of an influence this had on Linklater mm-hmm. and other filmmakers, because it's, like you said, it's a dialogue-driven film. It takes place roughly in real time, from my understanding. It's really just this conversation. So once you told me about it, and once I started learning about what the movie actually mm-hmm. was, I started getting very excited about it. So it's kind of the perfect excuse to watch this movie. Mm-hmm. I have very, very, I don't want to say high expectations, but I am excited to watch it, because I feel like it's, like, right in my wheelhouse.
You're a fly on the wall for two men who are much smarter than you having conversations about things that you maybe have never considered before. It's very interesting.
All right. Well, when was the last time you watched it?
A month, 2 months ago.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit longer.
You probably said that, and I'm terrible. And everyone knows that you said it, and I just seem like an ignorant, terrible monster. But that's okay.
Not to me, Sean. Not to me.
There's such love in your eyes, and I appreciate it. So, yeah, I'm definitely excited to watch this. And I am also excited about The Nerd Party. Do you like how I transitioned into a plug for this network? So The Nerd Party, if you don't know, is the network that Missing Frames is a part of. There are tons of podcasts. They deal with all kinds of nerdiness. There's stuff about Doctor Who. There's stuff about Star Trek. There's just general stuff about movies and TV and all kinds of geekdom. And I highly recommend you follow us on Twitter at Join Nerd Party. You like the Facebook page, The Nerd Party. And maybe don't talk to them about My Dinner with Andre. I don't know if anyone else has seen this movie, but you know what? The whole point of Missing Frames is we go and we watch movies we've never seen. That's why we're the best. No, we're not the best. We're just one of many amazing, amazing podcasts. So go check them out. And then other than that, I'm very excited to watch this movie.
I am too. I second all that about The Nerd Party, and I'm very excited to watch this movie again.
He's giving so many thumbs up you don't even know right now. So let's go ahead.
Five.
At least five thumbs up. That's a lot of thumbs up. So we'll go ahead. We're going to go watch this movie, and we'll be back to discuss.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. As Dan just said before we started recording, I am going to be the Andre of this conversation.
I'll be the Wally. And,
you'll be the Wally, which is totally perfectly fine. I will first of all say what anyone who hasn't seen this movie, they're desperate to know, which is that, yes, Wallace Shawn does say inconceivable in this film. And it caught me completely by surprise. And I didn't realize how delighted I would be to hear him say that word. So I'm not going to lie. I did not dislike this movie. I don't know if I liked it, but I found it very interesting. Mm. And I will say this much. I think if I had turned this off 45 minutes into it, I probably would have been like, that's one of the worst movies I've ever seen. I would have probably put it on a shelf with Easy Rider, which is another movie I should probably see again. But I was equally bored by at the beginning. Part of the problem for me in the beginning, and I'm interested to hear your take on this. My problem is we start the movie with a voiceover with Wallace Shawn. We're learning a bit about Wallace Shawn, and he's kind of walking through the city. We're getting a feel for him. He's a playwright, blah, blah, blah. And then he goes and meets this guy, Andre, who is a friend of his from theater, but he's been avoiding him for reasons you kind of understand a bit as the movie goes on. But then for nearly an hour, it's basically they sit down for dinner and Andre goes on just a complete one-sided rant. And Wallace will prompt him every so often, like, well, what about, why'd you do that? What is this? How is that happening? But my problem is watching it, I was really like, I'm just not into Andre that much. The stuff he was saying was like very focused on his own personal experiences, a lot of weird theater stuff, a lot of traveling he did, some strange experiences he went through of like being buried alive. But the problem for me is, you know, you're watching him talk and you're watching him talk and you're watching him talk. And I was like, is this like Andre was like, let's just make this movie as an excuse for me to talk about how amazing I am and all these experiences I've had. Cause I was very like, just not engaged with it. I was kind of like, I just don't care. I really don't care. And I was ready to write the movie off at that point. I was like, I'm bored. I'm not interested. I don't want to listen to this guy talk anymore. Cause he just seems like he likes to listen to himself talk kind of like me, since I have a podcast and I'm the only one talking right now, which is why I'm the Andre in this conversation. So it's allowed. I'll give myself props for that. When the movie started to win me back over was around the 45-50 minute mark, when Wally started to pipe up. He started to talk, he started to interact, and then it became a mutual conversation. And it occurred to me as I was watching it that so many of the movies I love that are dialogue driven are just that, dialogue driven, that it's a conversation, kind of a almost a tennis match, if you will, of dialogue going back and forth
and give and take.
Yeah. And I wonder, how do you feel when you watched this movie for the first time? Was that something you felt as well? Was it hard to get into, or were you pretty much there from frame one?
I definitely agree with you, but as the movie goes on, you realize why it's set up like that. You realize you need this context. You need this sort of bizarre opening. You need to understand the concepts that are brought up later, having Andre explain his kind of bizarre life over the last few years, to set the stage for the questions that are going to be asked later that don't really have a resolution, I guess. The weird experiences are a contrast to the lives that we live, and it's unrelatable and it's strange, but it kind of later on allows you to question the subway-filled life that Wally lives. It provides a contrast point to the lives that I think most people live.
Sure. Go ahead.
I've haven't had weird dances in the forest, and I haven't been buried alive, and it's hard to relate to that. But at the same time, you start to question, maybe I should have experiences like this. Maybe this is what living should be about, instead of going to the Xerox shop and picking up stationery and trying to write your plays.
Right. Well, here's the thing. You heard it here first. This episode of Missing Frames is a ringing endorsement for being buried alive. So everybody get to it. I get what you're saying. And I think it does set up, what it does set up is Andre Andre in general. You get a really good sense of who this guy is. My problem is, did it really need to be that long? Do you think we could have gotten the same feel for Andre with 20 minutes of him kind of having a one-sided conversation versus 40 minutes?
I feel like Andre is a interesting character. Like, I think they're both interesting characters. They're not stereotypes. They're not simply voices that voice one opinion. And I think having that multifaceted sort of bizarro rant that Andre has for, again, the first 45 minutes of the film, it sets up the kind of complexities of the character. It's novelistic. It's like a play. It definitely is not a movie sort of standard way to set something up. But I think if you read it on a page, it would make more sense in that sort of context. Right. It feels like something based off of a novel or a play. Yeah. It was not, from what I understand, but...
Well, it wasn't. It was the two of them. I think Wallace... Apparently, they'd met. They were, like, friends. Mm-hmm. Like, they'd done theater together. And Andre Gregory was looking to kind of write an autobiography, I think. And Wallace Shawn he wanted to write something that was like a conversation, like some sort of conversation piece. And the two of them kind of met in the middle. And you can, like I said, you can kind of see the autobiography elements. Although the two of them swear it's not autobiographical. Like, they're not necessarily playing themselves. Mm-hmm. Wallace Shawn, I think it was him who said, he's like, you know, if we ever do it again, we would switch the parts. And I would play Andre and he would play Wally. And he's like, it really isn't supposed to be a reflection of, like, us, who we are. It is interesting that you do kind of see that, and you do kind of feel it feels so naturalistic, and you do buy into, like, like, you believe it. These are two completely believable people,
and they often hold paradoxical views in their head at the same time. And there's nothing clear cut about their ideology and their views of the world. They definitely feel like real people who have unresolved paradoxes that they are oblivious to and they live with, especially Andre.
Yeah, it's tough because, like you mentioned, it feels like a theater play. Like, it's interesting that they did this as a movie and not a play, and that it wasn't a play first, because it's very clear that Wallace Shawn, they're both into the theater, that they were both, they started as theater actors, and it's a very theatrical film. That sounds ridiculous to say it like that, but I mean that in the way that it feels more like a play than it does a movie. And it makes it hard to kind of jibe with it at first, because I was thinking, I was like, you know, if I was, like you said, if I was reading this, it would be a little bit more interesting. But the fact that they're kind of sitting there and it's just for a while, it's just Andre talking. I was like, did I really need this movie? Like, did I need this to be a movie? You know, and it's interesting, you know, comparing it to Linklater again, who is I'm a huge fan of, and a lot of he loves this movie apparently, and he's gained a lot of inspiration from it.
Sure.
And what I think a lot of his films do with it is, there is, someone told me when I was expressing my love of the Before movies, they were like, oh, I saw those, but those should just be plays. It's just two people talking. It shouldn't, I don't get why it's a cinematic thing.
Sure.
And for me, at least, the reason why is because each movie takes place in a different setting. It's very cinematic in that way, where you don't get that from the theater. You need that from the photography of the location, but also they're an expression of time. They take place 9 years apart. You don't get that from a theater experience. You get that from watching it captured on film. And that was a tough thing for me watching. They don't really move around. And for a while, it was hard to engage with the conversation, because it's not a conversation. It's just him talking and Wally kind of prompting him, like, well, tell me more. But about halfway through the movie, it becomes way more interesting to me, because Wally really starts to engage. And I think if there's anything you could credit that first 45 minutes with, it's that. Because Wally is kind of a very insular individual, he's very, you know, he talks about how much he loves his comforts and how much he loves, still, I just like to go home and read a book, and that's okay. Why do I have to feel like that's not a good thing? But you get the sense that Andre's complete openness and his willingness to experience things is what then prompts Wally to all of a sudden, boom, I'm part of this conversation and I want to try to get on your level.
Yeah, or rebut his ideas to varying degrees of effectiveness.
Yeah.
I think Are we going to go into like the second half of the movie now?
Yeah, is that cool? Let's do it. We'll go all over.
Okay,
there's no stopping us. We're let's do it.
I think Wally kind of is a representation of the Enlightenment style thinking and utilitarianism and the modern kind of viewpoint of the world.
We're getting real deep, people.
We're going to bear with us.
Grab your armrests and get ready. We're going in.
Wally uses objects in the world. One of my favorite parts is the part about the heated blanket, the electric blanket. And this idea of this disconnect that technology and comfort and modernity imposes on us through a utilitarian, rational way of experiencing the world for, you know, a min-max sort of way of viewing things.
Yeah.
Instead of a complete openness to experience and deep thought about uncomfortable subjects. I think that Wally is supposed to represent most people who view this movie.
Yeah.
And it's designed to kind of present a new way of thinking about your interactions with the world and other people and objects. And I feel that Andre represents, while eccentric and bizarre, a way of thinking that's very foreign to most people. And I think that increases his bizarreness and increases his kind of unlikability, especially at the beginning, until you start to realize the challenges that he presents to modernity and
normalcy in general.
The sleepwalking way, the zombie way of thinking, as he describes it.
You know what's funny about the electric blanket is apparently the set was so cold that between takes they had to use electrical blankets to warm themselves up. The irony. It's beautiful. But a large part of the second half of the film is Wally, kind of Andre prompting Wally to really examine himself and look at himself and say what these comforts, like an electrical blanket, is that keeping you from experiencing life? Are you blocking yourself out? You know, Wally's like, you know, I don't want to just sit and do nothing. I want to sit and I want to read a book. And Andre is like, you know, I think it's interesting that you can't just sit and do nothing, that you feel like there is no solace to be found in that.
Sure.
And it's the conversations become very fascinating. And I'm wondering, there's a few that they talk about. Is there a particular one that stands out in your mind as maybe like your favorite or the one that resonates most with you?
I think the bits about where Andre talks about us, you know, the stars and the sky and the weather, if there isn't something like climate and the changing of seasons that can penetrate our cocoon we've created for ourselves in this society, we only have two things. We have our minds and our internal life, and we have the external world, and we've become alienated from both of them through the last 300 years of technological progress in the Western society. And are we doomed to live automatically in unfulfilled lives?
Right.
And I called this before the scariest movie ever made, because you start to realize how alienated you and me are from the external world and from our true selves below the layers of trying to seek satisfaction from objects or approval from people. What do we really want? Who really are we? What is this life thing all about?
Yeah.
These questions that we don't have answers to.
It's kind of the strangeness of doing a podcast episode of My Dinner with Andre, because the idea it presents is like, how are you presenting yourself to people?
Sure.
How we can't ever truly connect with people because we're only presenting certain versions of ourselves. And I, you know, just to put it in, to put it back on me, it's always interesting and it's great to have new people on the show, because it's always a different vibe for me, and I'm sure it's a different vibe for our listeners too. But I also find myself as a host having to adapt to whoever comes on the show. I have to adapt my personality. I have to adapt the conversations based on who I'm talking to, which is not even supposed to be, it's not a negative thing at all. It's not knocking anybody. It's not saying that one person is better than the other, but my wife is my favorite co-host, just in case she listens to this. No, but really, it's interesting how we do adapt to mm-hmm. different people. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I think it's a reality of life. You tend to alter your truth, like mm-hmm. the truth of who you are, based on who you're interacting with. Yeah. And I think a lot of times we find that we want to be around the people who allow us to be the most honest or truthful version of ourselves. Mm-hmm. Or at least that's how I feel. Some sure. people don't, they're very uncomfortable with that. Like Wally in mm-hmm. this movie is very uncomfortable with the idea of being open. Andre kind of prompts this version of himself, mm-hmm. this version that Wally kind of keeps locked up. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting thing. But like, that was one of my favorite moments, yeah. I think, when they were talking about the different masks that we wear and how we can't, like, are we even real? Like, do we even connect with people? Do we pretend? And do we, like, is it true connection if you're just a version of yourself?
When's the last time you felt you?
Are you asking me?
No, I mean, I'm
like, is that just a general rhetorical question?
That's the request.
I'm not me.
That's a question.
I'm not me. Who am I?
I think that's a question that the movie prompts. I feel like, who are you? And when was the last time you were alone with yourself and really looked at yourself? Not the mask version of yourself, not the version you present to the world. What is the thing underneath of it all?
Yeah.
And has anybody ever seen that? And have you ever seen that?
Right. That's the scary thing, I think. Yeah. That to me, that's what makes this, when you say this is one of the scariest films you've ever seen, if not the scariest, mm. that's the scary thing for, I think, a lot of people, mm-hmm. is some people can't. Like we were saying, Andre finds it disturbing that Wally can't just sit down and yeah. and be in silence and be in quiet, that he has to always be doing something. Mm. And people are fearful of that. People are scared to sit down and just take a moment and look at themselves. You know, we especially in this day and age, mm-hmm. we have the ability to distract ourselves with anything at any point.
Yeah.
So we are constantly finding a way to not have to connect. Now in a social situation, how many times have you found yourself, I try to actively avoid doing this, but how many times have you found yourself going for your phone mm-hmm. in an awkward social situation when you are the outside person in a group of people, when you're like, I don't know if I fit in, and yeah. your immediate comfort, it's almost your comfort food or your security blanket, is your cell phone. Mm-hmm. And so many people do that. And how many times have we avoided growing as a person by allowing discomfort and allowing ourselves to feel that moment and the awkwardness of it?
Even the slightest discomfort, the discomfort of feeling awkward or uncomfortable or even bored, mm. we banish it. And you look at some of the British philosophers like John Stuart Mill, who talk about, you know, maximizing pleasure and happiness is the chief goal of man. Well, we followed that for 300 years, and we are very frail, sheltered beings who can't stand the least discomfort. Mm. Has it made us better people? Has the idea of banishing all discomfort and banishing and mastering the earth and mastering the weather, has it completely alienated us and made us into unfeeling, sheltered, miserable people?
Right. Are we, it kind of had a brave, the movie had kind of, have you read Brave New World?
I have.
Yeah. So it had kind of a Brave New World vibe. And mm-hmm. to anyone in the audience who hasn't read Brave New World, it's great. It's kind of, I mean, it's terrifying, but the idea of Brave New World, it's kind of like the other dystopian novel. Mm-hmm. If you put like 1984, George Orwell's 1984 on one end of the spectrum where it's like really dystopian and terrifying, mm-hmm. Brave New World is almost more terrifying because it feels more like the society we live in, which is the idea is that we are being controlled through drugs, through entertainment, through medication, mm-hmm. but we don't care. We know it, but we don't care because it's basically, the idea is society won't fight back because we've given them television to distract them. And yeah. anyone could say, oh, I don't like my life, but oh, I have Netflix now. And I got that vibe from this movie, that mm-hmm. that was kind of what this movie was trying to yeah. say, that we are in danger constantly of falling into patterns and falling into comfort zones. They talk a little bit about how relationships and marriage can kind of put you in a comfort zone, or mm. how, you know, a job can put you in a comfort zone and you think, oh, I'm living my life, but then you get a sure. moment of clarity where you're like, wait a second, no, I'm not. I'm stagnating. I'm standing yeah. still and I'm not going anywhere, which I thought was really fascinating and a really interesting idea, but also terrifying. Like I said, it had a very Brave New World kind of feel to it.
It they mention Heidegger in this movie, and a lot of these themes are from his work. And I scratch the surface of this stuff. Mm. But I remember watching it for the first time, and I'm like, they got to talk about Heidegger. Like, this is like straight out of his stuff. But one of his disciples, a guy named Herbert Marcuse, wrote a book called One Dimensional Man. And it essentially touches on the fact, the automaton nature of modern society and the way people, by primarily thinking of themselves as a worker and a consumer, the guy at the cigar store next door, he isn't going to be really living in the same way that Andre lives when he's buried alive or dances in the forest.
Yeah.
He works a job he hates. He, you know, goes home miserable. He watches just enough television to feel good enough to go back to work the next day and does it again, and just enough to subsist, you know, to survive in the city.
Right.
And I think the point of the beginning and ending where they have the shots of the city, especially the beginning, it's this contrast. It's this dystopian, almost looking world of the dirty city streets and the subway, and compared to these beautiful stories about human beings living out their potential.
Which, by the way, was shot in Richmond, Virginia.
Oh,
so
hey,
we gotta go back to that's the ringing endorsement to move back to Virginia. It's the only place where you can experience your true self. But but on the flip side, you know, speaking of the cigar store, because Wally brings up a really interesting point that I find fascinating and also kind of agree with, but the idea that why is going Mount Everest more special than observing the beauty around you and being, there's a balance to it. You know, Andre is almost a bit too extreme. Like I said, listening to him talk about everything he's accomplished is for me really boring, but when it triggers something in Wally, it becomes much more interesting. But Wally also brings up a really great point about, you don't have to go to Mount Everest. The cigar shop next door, I could go in there and things would blow my brains out. And I think there is something to be said about that. There is something to be said about, sometimes we get so wrapped up in the idea of we have to go somewhere and we have to do something and we're not accomplishing enough. That can almost be as dangerous as not really doing anything at all, but forgetting to recognize beauty and the significance of moments and people around you can sometimes be a similar trap to what Andre is talking about.
I kind of feel the opposite of you. I think that
you're really Andre and I'm Wally.
I definitely relate to Andre more than Wally in terms
that's
of
what I was gonna ask. I was gonna say, who do you feel closer to?
Definitely Andre. I think that, again, we've prioritized monetary gain in society. We've prioritized technological growth and this sort of values that we put in society is what's reflected in society. We live in a society where we're exposed to ads every 5 seconds. We live in a society where we bulldoze trees to build roads. And the values that we did not program into our society, like beauty, personal dignity, true human expression and honesty, are nowhere to be found. And I think the last refuges of those, the outposts that they talk about for human experience, are these places of true beauty and connection with nature. Because, again, we've been so alienated from it. We are like orphans from the environment that we were built to operate in. Human beings didn't come from human beings weren't designed to go on subways and walk around concrete blocks and live in squalor. You know, we were designed to connect with the world that we are a part of.
Yeah.
And by robbing beauty, I feel like we've made it much harder to experience some sublime human living, true expression. And I think the cigar store, with all the labels and prices and the dead-eyed people who are there and the city noise in the background, I think it is nearly impossible to have a sublime experience of true being in any sort of real sense.
To an extent, I agree with you. But at the same time, I think that way of thinking can be dangerous, because if you're cutting yourself off from experience things that are right in front of you and from, if you, I guess what I'm trying to say is, if you cut yourself off from the possibility of experience something. Because I completely agree with what you're saying. We're bombarded with ads. Being in a cigar store is not going to compare to the Mount Everest.
Sure.
The concept is what I agree with. The concept of there is something that could be waiting all around you. The reality is people are going to be trapped in certain situations. People are going to be trapped in situations they don't like. How do you make the most of it? If you find yourself in a situation where you're imprisoned by something outside your control, how do you deal with it? How do you adapt to it? And is there the possibility of missing out? The danger isn't so much that you need to travel, you need to go somewhere. I think there needs to be that in your life, and I think you should.
Sure.
But I also think there's a danger if you start to, like Andre is saying, become numb to it. If you forget to recognize that you're standing still, you're not really moving. If you start to become comfortable in a realm where you then have to realize, you have to kind of jar yourself and say, oh my gosh, I'm not living. That's when it becomes a problem.
I feel like you said, how do you escape that? I think the answer is in the movie. The guy gives him an acorn and says, get out while you can. I feel that recognizing the existence itself is fascinating. The fact that we exist in a way that we feel separated from nature. A dog or a deer or a tree doesn't have these feelings of separation. I'm a separate entity from the world around me, and that's weird. The fact that I exist and I'm here is bizarre, and I can't really comprehend that. Intellectually I can, but in a real visceral sense, I cannot. And I think the only times I've really felt that have when I've been in nature, this oneness with everything. And I think that even if in that cigar store, to really experience that sense of wonder of being, it takes a monumental effort. And even then, it's a fleeting illusion, because the next thing you know, somebody bumps into you, or you read something that, you know, jars you out of it, and you're back in your default way of thinking as a worker and a consumer in a post-capitalist society.
So for you, the issue is that being around people and being in a situation like that where you could be distracted is part of the problem, and really to obtain the I guess peace or to really be able to observe beauty, you have to kind of separate yourself from that, get away from the constant bombardment of like whatever noise and just the insanity of everyday life where people can kind of come in and bump you and distract you. You got to get away from that to really achieve true self, is kind of what you're saying.
It's like looking at a Coca-Cola billboard, and
which I've done on numerous occasions, specifically in Superman 2 and Blade Runner, because they have beautiful Coca-Cola advertisements that one includes General Zod being thrown into it, and the other one also includes a geisha across the way singing from another building. But that's neither here nor there. Go ahead, Dan. Sorry.
It's like looking at a Coca-Cola billboard, and it's hard to look at it and view it aesthetically and understand what you're looking at without images of Coca-Cola, like the drink, filling your head. It's hard to look at a price tag and just look at it as symbols or lines without thinking of the monetary value that's associated with these symbols. You have this programmed way of thinking that's kind of programmed in you from a very young age, where you can't just take things at face value. You have this film that's over everything of the way you were brought up in the society that you're in, and kind of freeing yourself from that shackles of seeing things as objects to be used, or people as objects, if you will, to appease or win over or make use of.
But at the same time, let me say this. Do you think there's value in a Coca-Cola advertisement where someone could say, oh, it makes you think you're thirsty, but what if you are thirsty and it gives you an option? Is there something valuable in that option to say, like, oh yeah, I do want a Coca-Cola? Are you subscribing to some sort of like someone forcing you to feel a certain way? Or is it okay that to basically say, yeah, I recognize that I'm now I want a Coca-Cola and that basically brainwashed me into thinking so. But hey, I actually do kind of want a Coke and I'm going to go get one. Is there, do you then gain power over the advertisement if you can recognize what it's doing to you? Or do you think you are just becoming enslaved by it?
I think
this is the most philosophical missing frames episode ever. It's all my dinner with Andre's fault. But sorry, go ahead.
I would not apologize. I'm here to talk about this.
That's why it's you, Dan.
I think that the society we live in programs false needs into people. When you're thirsty, you don't need a Coca-Cola. You need water. You don't need sugar water in your veins.
What if it's a water advertisement then? Do you think someone then going out to buy water is just becoming a part of the machine, or if they can recognize it and see it?
If it was a wise philosopher king who posted a billboard that says, keep yourself hydrated, I care about you, it'd be one thing. It's another thing when Dasani puts up a billboard and says, hey, buy our product. We want you to feel a certain way. We're going to implant these needs and feelings into you to manipulate you into giving us your money.
Sure, but they're also providing you a product you need.
True, but it's also naturally occurring in nature, and you could, you know, get it yourself. When you live in a society where people are the equivalent of domesticated animals that are harvested for, you know, their value. When you live in a society where human beings are thought of as
kind of the means to an end,
or a natural resource, if you will, to be harvested, it becomes more insidious. It's not beneficial to you.
Yeah.
You are something to be harvested, something to be used, just like coal, just like timber,
or the Matrix. But yeah, I mean, it is. I think the reality is, I get what you're saying, and I get like kind of the disturbing nature of it. But at the same time, it's also the reality, and being able to recognize the reality gives you an edge almost against it. To kind of recognize the powers that be, the fact that you're always going to have to deal with being advertised to, that you're going to have to pay something, that you are part of. You're a cog in a machine that we're all, no matter how much we fight, we're going to be a part of. But if you can at least, I think one of the biggest ironies of this film, and almost the message of the film is, you know, the fact that they're talking about like, oh, there's beauty in a cigar shop. There's more, just as much, if not more, than at Mount Everest. This movie is a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. Their conversation is a beautiful thing.
It really is.
Human connection is a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they're talking about things and they're kind of two different opposing views, almost like we are right now, what we're talking about, I think, is a beautiful thing. I don't know if anyone listening does, but I hope you do too. But the irony is they didn't have to go to Mount Everest to experience that beauty. They are having, my dinner with Andre, the beauty of it is it's a dinner in just a hotel in New York City. And they were able to experience something beautiful and connect in a profound way, despite the fact that they are almost struggling against the forces working against them. But they're in a completely kind of bland, standard thing, consuming, purchasing, buying things, doing all the things they're talking against. But that's kind of what I think, why I think there is some credibility to Wally's point, that there is beauty to be found, that their conversation, this very mere fact that it was filmed and it exists at all.
Yeah.
And that we were told that this is an important thing to watch means that somebody thought it was. And even if you don't necessarily love the film or embrace it as many people do, the fact that it exists at all means that people were willing to say, like, there's some value to this.
Yeah.
And putting the camera on a situation, it's not like they're walking through nature. It's not like they're necessarily, sure, there's beauty to be found there. But the beauty of this film is that the beauty is their conversation, their bond. It doesn't necessarily matter where they are so much as the importance of them having that bond.
And I think it also slightly tarnishes the credibility of Andre's questioning of the ability of theater to wake people up.
Yeah.
And I definitely feel kind of more in touch with these questions that terrify me. The questions about my, you know, own existential, you know, dread of being myself and interacting authentically with other people. I feel more awake watching this movie to those questions and to those feelings that I try to cover up with purchasing and working and entertaining myself and trying to escape from in every way I can.
Do you feel like you're constantly performing? Do you feel like you have to perform to be accepted?
I'm doing it right now. I feel...
Right, I love, again, I think, I mean, I said this before, but it is funny that we're having a conversation about it, that we are technically performing for some metaphorical audience that may or may not exist, but we are performing in a way right now. But there's authenticity to what we're saying. It's like the performance may be a performance, just as it is in the film, but what is it telling people? What is it communicating? That's where I think the true value is, and where you can kind of say, it might be artificial at the end of the day. Someone might be listening to this in their headphones and not interacting with this, but there may be some value to get from it that may spark something in somebody.
Hopefully. Yeah. I think the scary point, though, is despite, you know, there being kind of a beauty and a awakening factor of philosophical discussions, I think the scary point, the thing that sticks with me more than anything else with this movie, is you realize these are the 0.00001% of all the people on the globe who have any sort of awareness of this dilemma.
Mm.
And you realize everybody else is just slumping through their lives, not really questioning it. And when they're miserable, they don't recognize the root causes of that misery.
Sure.
And you start to realize all these kind of forces of nature are, at least in the last 300 years, have been brought about by people slouching through their lives on automatic, not really questioning anything.
Right. Well, the beauty of art is that it does reflect. I think people can reflect and see. It holds up a mirror to you, and it allows you to... It triggers feelings like this. Sure. Movies like My Dinner with Andre trigger conversations like the one we're having right now, or allow you to kind of recognize the things in yourself where you need to improve. It's why I think art is so valuable, and maybe one of the most valuable, if not the most valuable form of expression we have, is being able to remind people through storytelling, even in a case like this where it's not necessarily storytelling. It's kind of presented as true life, but it is a form of storytelling to kind of remind people and trigger things and kind of just jog your brain and get you out of that complacency and allow you to recognize things that really matter.
The problem I have, though, with it, and I, just like Andre and Wally, we are the 0.001% who will get any value out of this movie.
Yes.
The rest of the society, the bagging lady at Walmart is going to watch Transformers 4 and go back to her job in the morning.
But then she'll discover missing frames on iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and she'll figure out. She'll be like, My Dinner with Andre. That sounds like an interesting thing right up my alley. Let me listen to these two wonderful men talking to each other. And then we've opened up a whole new world for her.
If only it were so simple, Sean. If only it were so simple.
So let me ask you one more thing.
Sure.
If My Dinner with Andre was made today, same actors, same people, same idea, concept of conversation, what do you think they would be most concerned about? I think the answer is obvious, but I still want to hear your thoughts. What do you think they would have talked about instead of the kind of the topics of the time that we're... They're still relevant, but I'm curious what you think. If My Dinner with Andre was made today, what do you think they would have talked about?
I think a lot of the social interaction that they discuss, a lot of that takes place online, and I feel like the forces of alienation and the forces of the mask wearing and the inhumanity to other human beings are accentuated online, if you will. And I feel the problems discussed in this movie have not diminished in the last 30 years. If anything, they've become a resounding screaming warning bell as we watch the beginning of a societal collapse.
My Dinner with Andre is almost a cautionary tale. And it's a reminder to me, of the importance of face-to-face interaction, of sitting down with somebody and communicating ideas.
Because, in an honest way.
In an honest way. Because social media has given us the ability to hide behind, you know, they talk about hiding behind masks and, you know, putting on different roles. But social media has given us the power to do that in a whole new way. In a whole new way, and given us a wider scope than we've ever had before, but also gives us the ability to be rewarded by it because we're being liked and followed by strangers who we'll never have a real interaction with. People can express themselves and they can condemn others without fear of repercussion, but it doesn't mean anything if you can't express yourself and condemn somebody to their face or do it in person. So I mean, obviously, I feel like the real thing we're both saying is that social media would probably play a huge part in their conversation and the way it's kind of brought people together while at the same time made us even more disconnected.
It's another example of technology that's supposed to make us more free and make us more open with each other, making us more hollow, one-dimensional, zombie-like individuals in a world that we are disconnected from.
Right. So it's the whole time. So how about that for being? And by the way, share this on your Facebook page. But you know, I think the thing about this movie and why it's great, and why I think I really start to connect with the movie more when Wally starts to speak up, is because there are. You should have points of view on these kinds of conversations. We should, it shouldn't just be one of us saying, I believe this, and you saying, well, I believe this. It's the two of us bouncing off each other and being able to communicate these things. Because the thing that's social media brings up the perfect example, the as negative as it is, and as I think there are detrimental things, and it's almost like a threat to humanity as we know it, there's also a beauty in it in that it does connect us with people. And when you can find people to connect with in a true way on social media, it's an incredible thing. There are people on Twitter and Facebook who I don't think I've ever met in person. A lot of people in the Nerd Party I've never met in person, but I feel such a profound connection to them that wouldn't have existed without social media. So I feel like there's I'm eternally an optimist as much as I am a pessimist too, but I feel like there's always a positive to a negative.
Obviously. And, you know, for as much as I sound like a Luddite who hates all technology at this point.
You do, Dan. You really do.
I mean, infant mortality has declined significantly. Modern medicine's amazing. We don't die from frostbite nearly as much because of electric blankets. You know, there's tons of positives, but I think the cult of worship of technology and progress and modern development has blinded us to the way it affects the human soul, if you will, the way it affects our identity as human beings. And we don't really wrestle with those questions because they're abstract and difficult and don't have clear answers.
Exactly. And I think one of the morals of this film is stagnation and standing still.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most dangerous thing. It's like social media can be a wonderful thing, but when that's your only means of communicating, or you kind of are like, I'm comfortable with never talking to anybody. I'm just going to tweet at somebody from now on for the rest of my life and cut myself off. When you start to just become comfortable and don't recognize that, like we're both saying this. We recognize the value in things, but you have to always be on your toes in a way and not allow yourself to become complacent. I feel like My Dinner with Andre, that's one of the biggest things it's preaching, is don't become complacent. Allow yourself the moment to think about something. Yeah. Why are you doing this? Is this valuable? Is it bringing true value to your life?
It's Andre talks about the electric blanket, and he compares it to being lobotomized. And I think if you I'm not judging. I do it too sometimes. But if you're going home every day and you're rewatching the same couple episodes of The Office that you've seen 100 times and you're passing out, you know, that stagnation, that dulling, that comfort is detrimental to who you are as a human being. Entertainment and comfort and technology can have a very detrimental effect on the human soul. And I think we see that all throughout society. And I think that's the real sort of interesting takeaway from the film in a lot of ways.
So let me ask you this, Dan, as we wrap things up.
Absolutely.
My Dinner with Andre, scale of 1 to 5, you give it a 5-star rating if that's the highest rating. One is the lowest. How many dinners with Andre would you give My Dinner with Andre?
I hate to be hyperbolic, and I don't like giving out high reviews because I always feel like there's always stuff that can be changed in a movie. It's just such a unique film. Mm. There's nothing quite like it. And I don't think I've ever had a film, except for maybe like Bergman or Truffaut, like, you know, one of those filmmakers, and even then in an abstract, fictionalized way, kind of touch on these issues. So I'd have to give it a 5.
Okay. Like,
I'm a huge fan of this film, and I'm very interested in the subject matter they talk about.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like being miserable, so I like thinking about things like death and SS officers.
I would never get that vibe from you because, you know, you can't see it, but he has a twinkle in his eye, and there's a pip in his step. I don't know if that's the right, I don't know. Whatever. I think as much as it pains me, I'd probably give it 2.5.
Okay.
And a lot of that is just, I think the first 40 minutes for me, the one-sided conversation kind of drives me crazy. But I agree with you. I think it should be seen. I think people should see it. And if anything, just to see this film has had so much influence in the cinematic landscape. I've already referenced Linklater, but you see so many films that are this style of people just talking to each other and connecting, and that's it. Mm. Like, you know, it's incredible that this film was made, and it was so unconventional. And I remember, I mean, Roger Ebert went nuts for it, and they even joked, I know Andre and Wallace Shawn, they joked that Roger Ebert's review kept them in theaters because I can't imagine what audiences in 1981, I think that's when it was released, would have. I can see people walking out of it. I can see people really not connecting with it, but, it's cool to watch from that regard. I think it's tough because it's hard to engage with at times, at least for me it was, but the ideas that it presents and the conversation it's prompted here, I think that's awesome that a film can do that. Whenever it does, I always hate to knock it, but I'm going to knock it anyway because it's my podcast. I can do whatever I want. But on that note, I want to thank everybody for listening. I hope you enjoyed this. I hope you got some value out of it, and I hope you go outside and talk to somebody because that is a wonderful thing to do. But if you're listening to us on iTunes, you can give us a 5-star rating. Wherever you're listening to us, give us whatever the highest rating is, because, you know, we love you, so just do what we want you to do. But Dan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for showing me this movie, and I hope we can have you back on to wax poetic some more.
Absolutely. If you want more pretentious rambling, I'll be available.
are you on Twitter anywhere where people can come stalk you?
I am not on Twitter.
See, that's what I thought. I was gonna call him out for being a hypocrite if he was, but
I've deleted all social media apps from my phone. I'm trying to practice what I preach.
Practices what he preaches. Good man. I, on the other hand, am at Ye Shonderman on Twitter. Feel free to reach out to me. I'm a total hack. But thank you so much for tuning in, and take care.